Welcome to Future of Freedom. I'm your host, Scott Bertram. Future of Freedom is a production of America's Talking Network. You can check out all of our great podcasts at americastalking.com. To support great podcasts like this one, please donate by clicking the link in the show description. We bring you interviews today with both sides of the debate over the adoption of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, in essence, changing the way in which we elect our president. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Trent England. He's founder and executive director of Save Our States. First, we're joined by Saul Anousis. He is former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party from 2005 through 2009. Saul, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
Talking today about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And we need to define our terms first. So if you could, somewhat briefly, tell us what we're discussing here. What is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact? What would it do? Where do we stand on it?
Okay, so basically what it would do is it would change the winner-take-all rule that currently 48 of the 50 states use, and two states, Nebraska and Maine, use what's referred to as a congressional district plan, and change that so that every voter in every state would be politically relevant every time. So today, four out of five voters live in a decidedly Republican or a decidedly Democratic state, and therefore are basically ignored in presidential elections. And so when we come down to elections, we're usually looking at three to five states that are referred to as battleground states. And what we're trying to do is create a system where every state is a battleground state every time, and that every voter in every state is relevant every time.
So if you want to replace something like the Electoral College, you must believe it's not working, or at least it's not the best system to elect a president. So when did the Electoral College stop working for the United States?
So we're not replacing the Electoral College. I would argue we're preserving it and strengthening it. The Electoral College will remain, which is basically the process that gives the states the right to determine how their electors are chosen. And electors will continue to be chosen by the states and go to the Electoral College. It's just a question of how those electors are chosen. It's the manner of election of the electors that we're changing. So the winner-take-all rule today says if you win Michigan by one vote, you get 100% of their delegates, and they all go to the Electoral College and vote in favor of that one candidate, whether the candidate wins or loses nationally. What we're doing is combining the votes in all 50 states so that all the voters are relevant every time. And the states that enter into and join this compact agree to cast their votes based on who wins the national popular vote. So the Electoral College remains. The strength of the Electoral College, which is the state's right to determine how their electors are chosen, how the elections are run, supervising the elections, that remains. But what we're doing is rather than just having a couple battleground states participate, we're making sure all 50 states participate every time.
Explain why this would change the way that candidates would campaign during the presidential election process. Under the current system of the Electoral College, at some point, campaigning in California stops making sense for candidates because Democrats are going to win and you get X
Correct.
Number of votes no matter what. In a process
Right.
in which a national popular vote matters for how certain states award their electoral votes, perhaps campaigning more in California and working the margins to increase a level of victory for a certain candidate makes sense. Would that not also be a problem in which you're trying to push the margins in states where you have extreme advantages?
Well, you would push the margins in every state. That's the advantage of this process, right? You take a look at, you would basically run a presidential race very similarly to how we run a race for governor or for the U.S. Senate in Michigan. You know, Michigan's a purple state that can go red under the right circumstances. So we're sometimes a battleground state, sometimes not. When you campaign in Michigan for governor or for U.S. Senate, you campaign across the entire state. You maximize your votes, from my perspective, in the Republican areas of the state, minimize your losses in the Democratic areas of the state, and ultimately every voter in Michigan has a voice in the process. So what happens under a national popular vote, the United States of America becomes a single member district. And so candidates will campaign across the entire country. They will obviously spend more time in more populated areas, less time in less populated areas, based on population, from a proportional standpoint. That's how most races are run across the country. But what you would do is ensure that the issues that are important to all the states are paid attention to. If you think about the idea that four out of five Americans are completely ignored in presidential process today, for all practical purposes, we're electing the president of the battleground states of America versus the president of the United States of America. So I believe that distorts public policy and it distorts politics. You know, battleground states get 7% more federal funding than non-battleground states. They're twice as likely to get exemption from a federal mandate like No Child Left Behind or something else. So whether it's a Republican president or a Democratic president or a Republican candidate or a Democratic candidate, they pander to the interest of the battleground states rather than looking out for the interests of the United States of America. We elect 514,000 elected officials in this country, all of whom are elected by whoever gets the most votes but one, the one candidate that represents the country as a whole. And the argument we're making is that this is the way the country ought to be voting for president. And if you go back to how the founders created the system and what the intent of the presidential process was, they tried to make it so that candidates would campaign in all 50 states, or at the time 13 states, and, you know, expand the vote. And they usually did that all the way through the 19th century. But as slowly political parties got more powerful, as people moved into states based on demographics, I mean, I think it was 1960. I think Richard Nixon's race was the last time a presidential candidate actually campaigned in all 50 states. And even then, he probably shouldn't have done it, but he made a promise to go to all 50 states. And even then, it was down to like 35 states. But today, there's 10 states or less that are potentially battleground states. And that's the problem we're trying to fix.
If we move toward a system like the national popular vote interstate compact, in which the national popular vote matters, should we be concerned about the different ways or methods in which states count votes, or at least the different rules that states would have in the occasion of a recount?
Yes, but no more or less so than we do right now, right? Every state has the right to determine how their electors are chosen, how their elections are run. Some states allow, as an example, felons to vote, others don't. Some states, you know, have early voting, other states don't. So today, we basically have a pool of 50 different states that would continue to administer their elections just the way they do today, and they would basically add those votes up and determine, you know, who the winner of the national popular vote is. And then what happens is the states that join the interstate compact, they agree to vote as a block for the candidate who won the national popular vote, which by definition then guarantees the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states becomes president of the United States.
There are going to be circumstances in which states in the compact end up pledging their electors to a candidate that did not win the state. How do you explain
that?
How do you explain that to voters, to worry about the reaction to voters in a state that say, hey, you're ignoring my vote in my state through this new process?
Yeah, we're actually not ignoring their vote. Right today, for instance, in Michigan, first of all, that's absolutely correct. Let's say Michigan were to vote for a Democrat and the Republican were to win nationwide and Michigan was part of the compact, then they would cast their votes for the Republican candidate for president, or vice versa in any other state. But what happens is every voter becomes relevant at that stage, right? So if Michigan were not a battleground state, as an example, in one given year, then the Republican votes who were to lose their election, right, they don't get any of their votes counted because 100% of the delegates go to the winning one. So under this system, whether you're the winning candidate or the losing candidate, the votes in your state get to count towards the national popular vote. So what that does is it guarantees that all the voters are represented, not just the winning candidate's votes are counted, you know, in a single block nationally. So from my perspective, I think what this does is it ensures that if you happen to be in a minority in this particular state, if you're like a Republican in Michigan who more often votes Democrat than Republican, it gives us a voice in every election. And I think that's important, both for the issues that are important to us and making sure we have a voice in who the next president is.
Talking to Saul Anousis here about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact here on Future of Freedom. There is a push in some places to move toward ranked choice voting. If a state were to adjust the way it cast its ballots for president to move to ranked choice voting, is there a way to take account for that in this proposal for the popular vote in interstate compact?
Yeah, absolutely. It is compatible with ranked choice voting and with any other method that people might choose to use in the future. It's specifically written so that the chief election officer of every state determines the vote count at the end of the election. Both by federal law and state law in all 50 states, they're required to provide what's called a certificate ascertainment to Congress, which is where the Electoral College formally meets. It actually meets in every state capital and sends up that certificate and their votes to Congress to tabulate. But they all are required to do that. And so whether you're using ranked choice voting or the winner-take-all rule or the congressional district plan, it really wouldn't matter. whatever the determination ultimately is by the Secretary of State, in most cases, of the chief election officer in that state, they would determine what the final votes are, and that would be the vote tally that's used.
The problem of faithless electors is not unique to either side of the system, since, as you explained earlier, the Electoral College remains in place. Is there any reason to think that that a faithless elector would be a bigger issue for national popular vote interstate compact than it is presently?
I doubt it. I mean, over half the states have already passed some type of faithless elector laws, which basically don't allow that to happen. And what normally happens is that party officials select the electors on behalf of their slates and their states. And so you usually have very dedicated partisan electors going to the Electoral College. So if you're sending Republican electors, they're going to vote for the Republican. If you're sending Democratic electors, they're going to vote for the Democrat. I think in the history of this country, there's only been like 11 actual, you know, faithless electors. And even then, they were basically casting protest votes. They were never voting when it really mattered. So it's really not much of an issue. And as I said, I think we're getting to the point where almost, you know, there's been discussions in over two-thirds of the states to move to a faithless electoral law that basically says you're going to vote for who you promise to vote for based on the way your votes are cast in your respective state.
If states wanted to make a change, could they choose to proportionally allocate their electoral votes? And would would that be an acceptable compromise in a way between these two systems that we're looking at today?
Well, the issue is it's not much of a compromise because it doesn't solve the problem, right? If you happen to live, let's say, let's stick with Michigan, you know, if Michigan had 10 electoral votes, which doesn't, it has 14, but if it had 10 electoral votes and the state voted 60-40, you'd split the electors 6-4. But if you vote, you know, 63, you know, 17, then all of a sudden, or 37, you don't have the numbers, right? Mm. You can't split electors. And so it kind of creates a distortion at that level. And so what we're trying to do is one of the principles of this is that we want to make sure that every voter is relevant every time. And the other problem with proportionality is that, you know, some states, you know, it will be very marginal what the difference would be. So like if you're in a very Democratic state like California, as an example, under a proportional system, the relative advantage of campaigning in California would be minor, where under a national popular vote system, California has more Republicans registered in California than 27 other states combined. So you would definitely see Republicans campaigning in California and turning out Republicans and conservatives who have voted traditionally in California for schools of choice, anti-tax proposals, et cetera. So I think what you're going to find is there's a whole lot of conservatives and Republicans buried behind the blue walls of states like California and New York, who today really don't have an incentive to come out and vote because under the presidential process, under the winner-take-all rule, their vote really doesn't matter. But under a national popular vote, when every vote matters, you know, we're going to be watching the results in California, we're going to be watching the results in Alaska and Hawaii if it's a real close election, because every vote will matter in all 50 states plus the District of Columbia.
You mentioned watching the results in California, and I have to ask because we know in recent elections, California saw has taken a long time to count their votes. And being such a populous state, again, the national popular vote matters. It could be 20, 30, 40 days until California counts all its votes. Are you concerned with the country being patient enough to wait for the results of a national popular vote?
Yeah, I mean, if that's the process and if California is that inept, then that's possible. But, you know, let's take a look at Florida as an example. Mm-hmm. It's one of the largest states in the country. And with the electoral reforms that they passed, they now literally have announced their results before 11 p.m. on election day. So it's not like it can't be done. I mean, look, we're still going to have a situation where state by state, we're going to have to worry about voter fraud, voter registration. We're going to have to worry about how voters are cast their votes and how the process works. So none of that's going to change. We're going to be under the same system we are now, where we'll have to worry about what happens in different states. But now we have an incentive from a kind of Republican standpoint to have a campaign and a working state party in all 50 states and engage and invest in the processes that are necessary for election day activities, for absentee voters, for early voting, for voter harvesting. Whatever the state laws are in those 50 states, we will have an incentive to make sure that every Republican or every conservative comes out and votes on behalf of the candidates that we happen to be supporting.
Final question for Saul Anousis here as we talk about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Tell us, how many states have approved this pact? How close is it to becoming a reality? And where are the states that might make it a reality?
Well, there's 15 states have already approved it, and we've got 195 of the 270 electoral votes necessary in order to join the compact. So the way the compact works is when enough states that have 270 electoral votes or more join the compact, it kicks in on that election year. And if any state pulls out, it drops back out and goes under the old system. So it kind of has a trigger of its own that you have to have a determinative number, because 270 is a magic number it takes to win the national popular vote. Today, the bill has been introduced in, I think, 46 different states across the country. Virtually every state has debated it at one stage or another. Michigan has it in the legislature right now and is talking about it. Minnesota has the bill pending, and there's been discussions on it. They've had hearings in Tennessee, Oklahoma, Arizona, Pennsylvania. So all across the country, there are states that are considering it and talking about it as we speak. And, I think, look, realistically, I don't think anything changes by 2024, but I think there's at least a 50-50 chance that by the 2028 election, we'll be running a presidential election under a national popular vote system.
Saul Anousis, he is former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party from 2005 through 2009. Saul, thank you so much for joining us here on The Future of Freedom.
Well, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Now to hear arguments from the other side of this debate, we talk with Trent England. He is founder and executive director at Save Our States. More at saveourstates.com. Trent, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
We talked today about the idea of a national popular vote, and more specifically about the idea of this national popular vote interstate compact. I want to ask you first about the Electoral College. This is a system that is more than 200 years old, clearly, and we've had many shifts in population. We've had many shifts politically across the country. Why is this old system still relevant and still perhaps the best one for use?
Yeah, that's a great question. That kind of is the big question that a lot of Americans have. The reality of the Electoral College is that it actually works better than the American founders even thought that it would, because they often thought that it would throw the presidential election into the House of Representatives, and it still does exactly what it was designed to do. The reason we have an Electoral College is that we had some very big states at the beginning and some very small states. The big states were Virginia and New York. The small states were kind of everybody else, but particularly, you know, your Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Georgia, right? I mean, those were very small population places, and they did not want to be ignored and really permanently shut out of presidential politics. And so they insisted on some kind of a balance. They used the balance that was created for Congress, really, that balance of power among the states, because the Electoral College is based on exactly the same power that states have within Congress. And we see the same thing today. I mean, California and New York, along with Florida and Texas, are really big states compared to a lot of other states. And the Electoral College it's just checks and balances. It puts an upper limit, a check, on how much power those big states can have. And by doing that, it forces some political balance. It spreads out that political power. And I would say I think it's more important today than even it was back in 1790.
You mentioned some of the big states, New York, California. Let's take California, for example. Under the Electoral College, presently, California is a sure loser for Republican presidential candidates. What is the incentive under the current structure for a candidate who is certain to lose, a state like California, which has a massive population, to campaign, to care about what California voters want?
Well, there are several reasons why both parties care. And, you know, California has become very politically extreme recently, but it used to be a Republican state. And, you know, if you go there, Or if you go to a national, you know, Republican meeting, there are still people who are trying to figure out, you know, how do we win back California? How do we become competitive in California? You know, the Democrats are a little more vocal about that when it comes to states like Texas. Texas is a little bit closer at the moment, but both parties are always looking to flip states. And I think one of the problems that people have with the Electoral College is they often take a snapshot. And or it's, you know, it's like they say in the military, they're always fighting the last war. The reality is that politics is very dynamic. And so you do see, you know, there is an active Republican Party in the state of California trying to win elections there. They do win a lot of elections at the local level. You know, they win some elections at the state legislative level. And they are desperately trying to figure out how to flip that state. And you see that in every state. You know, the Democrats are active in, not just in Texas, but in Utah, here where I live in Oklahoma, which, you know, by some measures is the reddest state in the country. But you go talk to Democrats and they have theories about how, you know, in a couple of election cycles, they could shift Oklahoma. And it's true. If the Republican Party, you know, stopped doing its job and, you know, stopped representing voters here in a way that that's palatable to them, then the Democrats really could make inroads here and the Republicans could in California. So over the long run, the Electoral College actually helps to make that a reality. It makes it so that the parties are constantly out there trying to figure out, you know, maybe not this cycle, but next cycle or the cycle after, what can we do to flip the state of California? The other thing that happens is that because the Electoral College really does push our politics out of the biggest, not just the biggest cities, but the biggest metro areas, the biggest media markets, it does force the candidates to pay attention to more voters. And, you know, this was on display a couple of years ago when voters in Maine, particularly lobster fishermen in Maine, got some attention from the Trump administration. And the National Popular Vote campaign said, look at this. This is terrible. You know, the Trump administration is paying attention to a couple of thousand people in the state of Maine because they're trying to win, you know, one of the congressional districts in Maine where they allocate electors that way. And, you know, I think the opposite is true, right? This is the genius of the Electoral College. You've got a president and a presidential campaign and a political party who care about the interests of a small group of people in Maine. But that the interests of those people in Maine is probably similar to the interests of fishermen in San Francisco and fishermen in the Puget Sound, where I grew up in Washington State, right? And so as these little groups of people get represented, there's also a spillover benefit that helps a lot of other people. And that's what happens when we push presidential politics outside of the biggest media markets.
The Electoral College, Trent, obviously allows the popular vote winner to actually lose a presidential election. It's happened a handful of times, twice in recent memory. This really bothers some people, that someone who recorded more popular votes than someone else could lose the Electoral College. Why should they be okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, that is something else that people really focus on. And it's kind of surprising when you zoom out and think about politics all around the world. In every parliamentary system, at least all the big ones that I'm familiar with, that's a possibility. It's happened in the last two elections in Canada where the Liberal Party received fewer popular votes than the Conservative Party in Canada, but the Liberal Party won the election because they won the most seats in their national parliament. That happens in lots of other parliamentary systems. And it's because as soon as you have an electoral system that's based on representing people by districts, and in this case, in our states, that's a possibility. And it happens, it can happen in any state legislature, that one party receives more popular votes, but the other party wins more seats, and therefore they control that legislative chamber. They elect the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader of the Senate. They run all the committees. That happens in our own Congress. You know, the Constitution's written in the middle of the 20th century for India and for West Germany, each include a kind of electoral college system. And again, in a system like that, it's possible. It is the price that we pay to have a better electoral system, to have a system that has these checks and balances. It's, you know, it's what you get when you have a two-step democratic process. And the 2016 election and the 2020 election are actually great examples of the fact that all the Democrats had to do in, let's say, 2000, was win Al Gore's home state of Tennessee, hold the state of West Virginia that they had won basically since the end of Reconstruction. I mean, the Democrats had lots of possibilities to win that election. And they nominated a candidate, Al Gore, who had less appeal than Bill Clinton. They did not do the hard work that Howard Dean wanted the party to do of having this 50-state strategy, which really meant going out to more states where Democrats were at risk and focusing on some of those states. And just like Hillary Clinton in 2016, they ran this sort of insular campaign based on the assumption that they were going to win, that they could sort of, you know, run up the totals in places where they were already popular. And the Electoral College rewards outreach. It rewards going out to places where you haven't had support in recent elections and figuring out how to convince those voters. And George W. Bush did that well in 2000. And Donald Trump did that really fantastically well in 2016, winning over a whole bunch of states that the Democrats took for granted. And, you know, our electoral system rewards that kind of outreach rather than just, you know, a sort of base election where you know, Democrats drive up the vote in California or Republicans, you know, drive up the vote in a handful of southern states. I think it's a small price to pay for a much better system.
Trent England is with us. He is founder and executive director of Save Our States, more at saveourstates.com. The concept, of course, behind a national popular vote and this interstate compact is one person, one vote. Everybody in the country has one vote. They all count equally across the country. We add them up, we have a total. Is there a flaw conceptually in asking for one person, one vote for the United States?
Well, so there's two kinds of flaws with that. One is the national popular vote present that as if it's the only democratic principle, and that's just not true. There are lots of democratic principles, and you know, as I described, right, in parliamentary systems and legislative systems, that is a part of the process, but that is not the only part of the process. And just like, you know, we have a Bill of Rights that says to majorities, we don't care how big a majority you are, you can't do certain things, right? We have an electoral process that says we want some checks and balances. We want to spread that out. The Electoral College is one person, one vote within each state. And I think that's the important part, right? Just like within each legislative district, congressional district, it's one person, one vote, right? The Electoral College is one person, one vote within each state. The problem is, and what all these parliamentary systems recognize, what India and Germany recognize, what the founders recognized, is that when you take a really big, really diverse country and you say, we're just going to have a direct election, the one person, one vote direct election system at the national level, you create all kinds of possibilities for regional politics, for splinter parties, spoiler candidates, small plurality winners, right? Under the national popular vote plan, you could easily have a situation where Michael Bloomberg jumps in, Oprah jumps in, you know, Donald Trump jumps in as an independent candidate. You wind up with five or six legitimate candidates running to the extent that they have a lot of money to spend and they each have a power base in some part of the country. You could wind up with a winner whose support is focused just in one region of the country and who wins that one person, one vote election with 30% of the vote, right? Those are the hidden costs to the system that the NPV folks talk about. And those are big costs. I mean, those are things that strike right at the heart of having a stable political system, which is why almost no major democratic countries use a national popular vote for anything. Canada doesn't. The United Kingdom doesn't. Germany doesn't. India doesn't. Right. I mean, the countries that do are places like Mexico and Brazil, France. I guess France would be the biggest, most comparable nation, but not a paragon of stability in the Western world. So, I think the people who just talk sort of monomaniacally about one person, one vote really are missing a lot of other factors that have to come together to have a successful political democratic process.
Is there any evidence, Trent, that the Electoral College and the system depresses voter turnout in some areas? Again, let's just take California. If it's known to be, it's going to be 65-35 Democrats. Do more Republicans stay home? Does it matter if more people stay home if they know their state is a fait accompli?
So it's really hard to analyze that, because a state that is safe in presidential elections is also going to tend to be safe in gubernatorial elections, in elections for U.S. Senate, in a lot of their congressional districts, right? And so the MPV people talk as if all that matters is presidential politics and everything else doesn't exist, right? Obviously, that's not true. What we see, though, is that there are safe states that are very high turnout states, and there are swing states that have lower turnout than some of those safe states. A good example being a state like Massachusetts and a state like Vermont, right? Those are high turnout states, not because they are political swing states these days, right? Those are very blue states, but they have cultures of involvement, cultures of people turning out and voting. And so you don't have to be a swing state to get that. But, the National Popular Vote folks make this claim, especially to Republicans. They have sort of a whole list of talking points that they make to Republicans. And one of them is that, if you switch to a national popular vote, you would have all these Republicans who would turn out in California. Well, the fact is that Republicans tend to turn out anyway, which is why Republicans usually do better in midterm elections. Republican voters tend to vote as a matter of duty, whereas Democrats have cultivated at least some of their base to vote because they think they're going to get something out of it, right? It's more transactional. And therefore, if you think you're going to win or you think you're going to lose and you're a Democrat, you're less likely to show up than if you're a Republican. But the National Popular Vote's claims were put to the test in California. I mean, we had an actual test that we got to run, and that was called the 2021 California Governor Recall. This was a good controlled test. It was a September date in 2021. Nothing else was on the ballot. Republicans were really fired up in California. They had the candidate that they wanted. And unfortunately, Republicans basically lost that election by the same margin as they had in the presidential race the year before. So there's not this big hidden reserve of Republican voters who don't show up at the polls in a state like California or anywhere else. It's just empirically not true. And, we don't have to theorize about it anymore.
Trent England with us, founder, executive director of Save Our States, saveourstates.com. Is it even possible to have a national election in this matter? We have states who now have different rules in terms of ranked choice voting in certain areas. You have states that conduct recounts in different ways. You have states that take 6 weeks, 8 weeks to actually count votes after Election Day. How would this even work from a realistic standpoint of conducting an election across the country?
Yeah, this is the Achilles heel of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. They talk as if it's really easy to just cobble together all these election results from different states, and it isn't. And it's probably also illegal under the U.S. Constitution and interpretations of it by the U.S. Supreme Court. You're right. You've got states like New York being particularly egregious, that in presidential elections in recent history just don't finish counting all the ballots by the deadline. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But, you alluded to one. They've got these election policies, and this is true of a lot of blue states, that allow ballots to trickle in for a long time after Election Day. Some of them are now, the state of Maine, Alaska is doing this right now. Although they're trying to repeal the system, but they're using ranked choice voting. All of these things make the election process more complicated, and they make it take longer. And New York, most dramatically in 2012, had over 400,000 ballots that they had not counted by the time they certified, or at the time they certified their presidential election results. Now they knew that was not going to change the outcome in the 2012 election, because the margin between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama was almost, I mean, it wound up being just shy of 2 million votes, right? And so they knew 400,000 ballots wasn't going to swing the outcome. But what are other states going to do? So the way the National Popular Vote Compact works, the chief election official in each state that's in the compact, so the compact is trying to take effect with about 20 states, right? 20 to 21 or 22 states, as long as they've got, you know, a bunch of the big states in there and they've got California, you know, would be enough to give them control of presidential elections, put the compact into effect. And then in each one of those states, this official, the state secretary of state or the state elections director, whoever that person is, would gather the election results from all of the other states and say, well, for our state, you know, for California or for New Mexico, we declare that this is the national popular vote total. And so this is how we're choosing our state's presidential electors. Well, what do they do when they get results from New York that they know are incomplete? Or more problematic, what do they do if, you know, if the Secretary of State of California gets results from, say, Georgia, and everybody on MSNBC is telling that, you know, that wannabe, you know, next U.S. senator from California or next governor of California or whatever that person wants to run for, all of their donors, all of their activists are being told that Georgia is Jim Crow 2.0. They rigged this election. It may look like the Republican won, but that's not true. Or Texas or wherever, you know, pick your red state boogeyman. Are they really going to just accept those results, especially if it means that California, instead of giving its presidential electors to a Democrat, is going to give them to a Republican, even though the state voted, you know, 64% for the Democrat? I mean, that's the kind of really practical problem that the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact would introduce into the system. And there's not really a good answer for it. I mean, if you look at the compact has, it says nothing about recounts, says nothing about conflicts, nothing about what happens when, you know, something unexpected happens. And, you know, I mean, I guess they just leave it all to judges, state judges, federal judges to sort out. But that seems like, it seems like not the best process. But that's where the National Popular Vote Compact would leave us.
Trent England, founder and executive director of Save Our States, more at saveourstates.com and on Twitter at Save Our States. Trent, thank you so much for joining us here on Future of Freedom.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
For more episodes of the Future of Freedom podcast and other fine podcasts from America's Talking Network, check out americastalking.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening to Future of Freedom, presented by America's Talking Network.